welcome to the second week of summer school. I'm Cheryl Nicolay of the Centre for Open Learning, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Professor Howard Phillips here this morning. Professor Phillips is not at all a self-promotional person, so I'm going to promote him a little, because for many years he has been professor in the history department, and he has done some very seminal work. His work on the, he wrote a very seminal book on the history of the University of Cape Town from 1918 to 1948, the formative years. And that book has been extremely powerful, I think, and it was acknowledged by Dr. Stuart Saunders when it was published, that it is extremely helpful. That book measures the years after World War I and also after World War II. And with the change, it was published in 1993, and with 1994 being a change of many, a great moment in South Africa, it has helped in understanding. It shows how history does really help to guide the future if it's sensibly applied. But Dr. Phillips has also published a number of other books. I'm going to be a little bit shamelessly promotional here, because here you have the nice alliterative pandemics and plague, pox, and pandemics. And his interest specifically in South African history has been in the medical field, and he is a specialist in this field. And also, another thing about Dr. Phillips is that he has been also instrumental in making a number of historical films through the History Department, which are of great archival value to Cape Town and to South Africa. The History Department has been very active in this field, and Dr. Phillips has been instrumental in causing these to be made. And so I think we owe him, as Capetonians, as South Africans, quite a significant debt, and I'd like to welcome him, and I'm sure you'll have a very, very interesting lecture week. Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to the first in a five-part series on epidemics in South African history. The focus of today's lecture is on smallpox. There are no people left, only stones. It's very movingly, one person in the 19th century spoke about the effects of smallpox. I want to go back further than that by pointing out to you that tomorrow, 2 weeks from tomorrow, on the 12th of February 2013, that will mark the 300th anniversary of the arrival in Table Bay of the return fleet of the Dutch East India Company on its way home from Batavia, now Jakarta in Indonesia. The arrival of these nine ships in Table Bay on the 12th of February 1713 might otherwise be ignored as one of the many arrivals in Table Bay. But for the purposes of this particular series, it's of critical importance. During the 11 weeks that those nine ships were crossing the Indian Ocean, smallpox broke out on board several of those ships. And by the time that they anchored in Table Bay, 22 people on board the nine ships had died, and many more of them had been struck down by smallpox. When the ships anchored in the bay, the blankets and linen were landed for laundering, and that was fairly standard and fairly customary. And as again was the routine, they were taken by slaves to the streams above Cape Town, particularly the Plutticut stream. There's a photograph taken of that very stream at the top end of Buitenkracht Street, Buitenkant Street, and really, it's an area which is still known as the Slave's Walk. So the linen from these nine ships was taken by the laundry women up to be washed in these streams. What they were not aware of, but with hindsight we are aware, is that smallpox's ability to the ability of the virus, the smallpox virus, to lodge itself in cloth meant that in fact anyone who came into contact with clothing or linen which had been used by smallpox victims was not unlikely to be infected. And indeed, within 2 weeks, smallpox had broken out amongst those slave laundry women, and it spread to the rest of the town from them. And that was the first of many epidemics to reach South Africa. And so on the 12th of February 1713, 2 weeks from tomorrow, that 300th anniversary is of critical and pivotal importance in shaping the history of South Africa, as I will be outlining for you today. Epidemics and their effect on society are indeed one of the great silences in the tale of South Africa's history. And it's those silences that in these five lectures I wish to redress. I want to explore in these lectures whether there are common patterns to be found in the cause, in the course, and in the consequences of epidemics which have hit South Africa. And really to underline why epidemics matter, why indeed they have been of such formative significance in the history of South Africa. In the words of one historian of epidemics, an epidemic tempers society. It is the litmus test of civilization. In these five lectures, we'll be looking at how South Africa was affected by this litmus test of civilization, how it emerged from this primal test of the nature of society. Before I begin the lecture proper on smallpox, it's probably helpful just to elucidate a couple of terms that I will be using frequently in the course of these lectures. So just by way of intro, let me explain the meaning of these half dozen terms. First of all, the term epidemic, it comes from the Greek epidemos, which means on the people. An epidemic is an unusually high occurrence of a disease in one place or one region or one continent. A pandemic is an epidemic spread very widely beyond just one place, one region, one continent. Pan, of course, means all. So pandemos is on all the people. So a pandemic is an epidemic writ large, stretching over several continents. The other end of the scale is the word endemic. Endemic is the usual low-level occurrence of a disease, the one which sort of simmers on without bursting into great explosive outbreaks, rather like an epidemic. The fourth term that I will be using in these lectures is a virgin soil epidemic. That's an epidemic which breaks out amongst the population that has no prior exposure to the disease and thus no prior immunity to that disease. So a virgin soil epidemic is one which hits a, you might call, an immunologically innocent population, one that has no immunity and no prior experience or exposure of that disease. To complete the series of epis, epizootic is an epidemic amongst animals or insects. I will occasionally use this term epizootic. It's really the animal equivalent of an epidemic. And finally, the word vector. A vector is a carrier of a disease. The vector may or may not show symptoms. It may be symptomless vector, but it's someone or something that actually carries the disease. So those are terms which will recur in these five lectures, and it's helpful that you have an understanding of what I mean when I use these terms. So let me turn to epidemics in South Africa. for most of human history, in other words, the last, say, 20,000 years, Southern Africa, rather like Australia, rather like Latin America and North America, for most of the period of human history, Southern Africa has been free of human epidemics because it was separated by seas, by deserts, by jungles, by distance from the old world, from the Middle East, from Asia and the Mediterranean basin. In those areas, the Middle East, the Mediterranean basin, Asia, domestication of plants and animals, the growth of population, the rise of crowded towns, and the development of long-distance trade all fostered the emergence and spread of infectious diseases even well before the third millennium BC. So those areas, and you can only you need only to think of epidemics and plagues described in the Bible as a prime example of epidemics and plagues in the old world going back several millennia BC. And that it relates to social and economic and political changes which and demographic changes in those areas which I mentioned. But from these, because of distance, desert, jungles, etc., the Americas, Southern Africa, Australia, were pretty well protected and sheltered. As late as 1678, a group of koi herders told the Dutch governor at the Cape that, quote, "No particularly severe sicknesses are known amongst us. Death usually contents himself with old, worn-out people." To the Dutch, the koi appeared, quote, "generally free from visitations of epidemics, a circumstance which never, or at least very seldom, happens amongst them in comparison with the numbers carried off in the course of nature." So we have just a little bit of evidence from as late as the 17th century that there appears to have been no well-established pattern of recurrent epidemics in Southern Africa, even until the late 17th century. But the creation of Europe's commercial empires overseas from the 16th century onwards meant that this millennia-old separation of the Americas, of Southern Africa, of Australia, was increasingly breached by seaborne infections. By the end of the 17th century, the very end of the 17th century, increasingly we begin to pick up reports in the accounts of the Dutch governors at the Cape of infectious diseases breaking out amongst the indigenous koi population, becoming more frequent as they were exposed to pathogens to which they had no prior exposure, for which these we would probably call the beginnings of virgin soil epidemics. Under the weight of these new pathogens and the ongoing erosion of the koi's political, social and economic structures by Dutch colonization, koi autonomy and stability became increasingly compromised and fragile. What tipped this increasing fragility over the edge was the arrival in 1713 of what already was well branded in Holland as the worst of all the harpies, smallpox. While smallpox existed, it was eradicated finally and fantastically in 1978. While it existed, smallpox was caused by the variola virus, which is easily spread, was easily spread from an infected person to others by coughing, by talking, or, as you've already heard, by contact with bedding or clothing utilized by someone who had smallpox. Close proximity and crowded conditions thus favored the transmission of smallpox, while its high infectivity meant that any and every contact with someone who had no such immunity was likely to be someone at very high risk. A highly infectious disease, easily spread, particularly in overcrowded and close contact, and very likely once it was in the air, as it were, to spread widely. after incubating symptomlessly in an infected person for about 12 days, smallpox began to make itself felt by a rising fever, a splitting headache, and then those telltale symptoms, blisters in the throat and a rash that quickly ripened into blisters on the skin, which turned into pus-filled pustules, particularly on the face and on the limbs. In 20 to 30% of cases, death followed within 7 to 10 days as a result of multiple organ failure or respiratory complications. Recovery in those who did not succumb took 5 to 6 weeks, during which that person remained infectious. However, if someone survived the disease, they usually acquired lifelong immunity, but often at very high personal cost. Many were left grossly scarred by pockmarks, blind, and infertile. For smallpox itself, there was no effective remedy. There was never any effective remedy. The best that biomedicine, even at its height in the 20th century, could offer was comprehensive and supportive nursing. If biomedicine was unable to provide an effective treatment, it did, however, contrive two preventive measures against smallpox. Both unwittingly, and we can see from the perspective of the 21st century, unwittingly based on the principle of immune response. In China, in the Middle East, and perhaps in some parts of Africa, already before 1550, healers were taking pus from these pustules, or the scabs themselves, from a smallpox victim, and introducing them into an uninfected recipient's system, either by inoculation, which meant that the fluid from the pustule was removed and rubbed into a cut in the skin. So that was one way. It's called inoculation or variolation. Or perhaps much less well known, but not unusual in the case of China, insufflation. Insufflation meant that they took a pustule, they ground it up into a powder, and that powder was then blown up the nose of an individual. That's one way, another way to introduce it into a system. Both produced a milder version of the disease, and this induced immunity in a person, provided he or she survived either inoculation or insufflation. In the 18th century, this immunity by inoculation technique was taken up in elite circles in Europe, and it spread from Europe to the rest of the colonies. That was the first mode of prevention. To our eye, very primitive, very crude, but it did provide a degree of immunity for those who were able to, for those who survived that insufflation or inoculation. The second preventive measure is the one perhaps much better known, devised by the English country doctor Edward Jenner in the 1790s. It drew also on the technique of inoculation, but instead used fluid from pustules produced by cowpox. Now, cowpox is a relation of smallpox. It's an unpleasant disease, but it is benign. And so if someone contracted cowpox, it would be possible to take the fluid from their pustules and introduce that into someone, and that would produce a degree of immunity. This was known because of cowpox, from the Latin word vacca, a cow. This was known as vaccination. Vaccination conferred immunity far more safely, and from the beginning of the 19th century, Jenner came up with this brilliant insight in the 1790s. From essentially the beginning of the 19th century, it rather sidelined inoculation and revolutionized the prevention of the disease around the world during the 19th century as the idea and the technique spread. the difference between inoculation and vaccination is so significant. It's such a distinctive watershed, the invention of vaccination, that really in this lecture I'm going to talk about the pre-vaccination age and the vaccination age. They really are quite different because of the effectiveness of vaccination. Let me start by talking about the pre-vaccination age. In the pre-vaccination age, i.e. before the 1790s, thrice the Cape was hit by smallpox. That epidemic, which I mentioned right at the beginning, in 1713, an epidemic in 1755, and a third epidemic in 1767. These three epidemics of the 18th century struck the Cape, largely brought from across the Indian Ocean by the Dutch fleet. In two cases, from Batavia, just to give you your bearings, here is the Cape of Good Hope. Batavia is there, that's Batavia. In two cases, it came from Batavia. In the third case, it came from the Dutch colony of what is today Sri Lanka, Ceylon. Whoops. Sorry. So these three epidemics brought by the Dutch fleet, by Dutch fleets from the Dutch possessions in the east. They were all part of an ongoing global pandemic of smallpox, which had begun in 1602 in Asia. In all three occasions, the vector seems to have been infected clothing. Clothing worn by or linen in contact with smallpox victims on those ships coming across the Indian Ocean. Passengers or members of the crew who developed the disease during the 11-week voyage across the Indian Ocean. Twice in 1713 and 1767, the first cases at the Cape occurred, as I've indicated already, amongst the laundry women, washing the linen and clothes of people who had had smallpox. The 1755 epidemic, however, the first victims were tellingly second-hand clothes dealers, obviously also coming into contact with the clothing of people who had died, or perhaps the linen of people on the ships. As in other smallpox-ridden seaports around the world, Cape Town's periodic epidemics owed a great deal to the presence in Cape Town and in the immediate environs of Cape Town of a significant number of non-immune people. A recent historian has explained that the non-immune population, quote, grew back steadily after each outbreak like underbrush after a wildfire. But when the susceptible population, i.e. those without immunity, had built up to a critical level, the balance would tip in favour of smallpox, and the arrival of just one or two infected cases could trigger a devastating outbreak. With so vulnerable a population present in Cape Town, cases multiplied rapidly once smallpox struck. Mortality was at the upper end of the range. Remember I said 20 to 30%. In Cape Town, mortality was at the upper end of the range, particularly amongst the most vulnerable and least immune components of the population, children, no prior exposure, and the Khoi communities. For example, in 1713, that first epidemic, 25% of Dutch colonists, 35% of the Dutch East India Company slaves, and an even higher percentage of Khoi died within the space of 6 months. Where before one saw youths amusing themselves in the streets, it now became deathly, and one scarcely saw a house that was not closed by death or sickness, observed one contemporary visitor to Cape Town very gloomily. While another contemporary visitor to Cape Town was told that the Khoi, quote, died as if by hundreds, so that they lay everywhere along the roads, as if massacred as they fled inland with kraals, huts and cattle. And here's a slightly later engraving of a koi burial. There are no images of what happened during the epidemic, but this was the traditional koi burial practice. You'll see the body here, the body here being carried and to be placed in a cave or a hole here. Here's the kraal and mourners going behind. It was an engraving done to accompany a book written by a man who was actually here during that 1713 epidemic. He doesn't describe the epidemic particularly, but it's likely that at least at the beginning of this 1713 outbreak, such formal funerals would have taken place. However, as the smallpox epidemic gathered pace, it's likely that these would have been completely abandoned, they were just no longer sustainable, and that vivid, they died as if by hundreds so that they lay everywhere along the roads, obviously made this kind of formal routine, formal funeral, are no longer sustainable. Confirming this decimation, early in 1714, a handful of koi arrived at the castle from the Picketburg area, requesting that the commander at the castle, the Dutch commander at the castle, should appoint new captains for them to replace the four who had died of smallpox. They reported that, quote, scarcely one out of 10 members of our society have survived. So absolute decimation. In 1755 and 1767, the mortality rate amongst the colonists and amongst the slaves was lower than in 1730. Perhaps acquired immunity, perhaps the arrival of new immune immigrants from Europe who contracted it in Europe, survived and had immunity. But for the koi and children, there was no such immunity. The disease's impact remained very dire in both 1755 and 1767. Empty kraals, unattended cattle, koi burial mounds heaped with stones bore silent testimony to the lethal nature of the disease well beyond Cape Town. As early as with the earlier epidemic in 1713, in 1755 and 1767, the outbreaks penetrated deep into the interior too, not just confined to Cape Town and its immediate environs. And we have some brief accounts of unprecedented decimation, even across the Orange River, in Namaqualand, in the Overberg, and indeed amongst the Xhosa in the Transkei. Indeed, in the Transkei, it's apparent that to prevent the disease infecting others, the Xhosa's traditional mode of caring for the sick in their huts was abandoned, so devastating and rampant was smallpox, and instead those with smallpox were sent into the bush to die of in isolation. Their relative, which is a complete break with the usual Xhosa tradition of treating and nursing the sick. And indeed, the relatives of such people had to be ritually purified before being allowed back into the fold. If we look at the response of the Dutch authorities to these devastating outbreaks, they changed markedly, as one perhaps would expect, over the course of 54 years, between 1713 and 1767, in keeping with changes, with growth of medical knowledge, and their growing administrative capacity. In 1713, what is most marked is a lack of organized medical and administrative response. Just about every household left to fend for itself. That's in quite striking contrast with the Dutch administration's measures in 1755 and 1767, when Governor Tilbach introduced a panoply of countermeasures drawn up with the assistance of Cape Town's doctors. They aimed to try and keep the epidemic at bay by tightening up disembarkation procedures, tightening up medical inspection of ships arriving in the bay, and indeed even enforcing quarantines. And then if these measures to actually prevent smallpox from landing failed, another set of measures were introduced to try and curb its spread with the aid of the Dutch Reformed Church, to provide nursing care for the sick, two isolation houses, one for indigent colonists and one for slaves. Clearly, if one looks at the way in which these measures were angled, they particularly targeted slaves. Slaves were identified as perhaps the likeliest portal for the infection to arrive. Slaves' place of accommodation was identified as requiring special supervision and close monitoring, especially if these slaves were involved in laundry work, and you can see the obvious connection, or baking, or butchering meat. Perhaps not obvious today, but in 18th century thinking, fresh bread, fresh buns, fresh meat were singled out because contemporary medical opinion believed that these somehow attracted all the foul humours in the air and somehow drew smallpox to them. It's, of course, a reflection of contemporary medical thinking. The medical opinion was less taken with the idea of inoculation. I mentioned that already in the 18th century in Europe, inoculation was becoming quite a fashion activity to prevent smallpox. But for reasons which are not clear, in the Cape, inoculation was not really instituted at all. It may have something to do with the rather conservative nature of the medical profession, or they aren't being out of touch, but there's not evidence that inoculation, even though in Europe and in Holland it was already being used, was introduced in the Cape. But if this perhaps conservative nature of the medical profession shaped the preventive measures of the Dutch East India Company, in the realm of individual treatment, it was not alone. There were other medical systems which were tried, which were drawn on to try and deal with smallpox. So not only was there biomedicine, state-of-the-art as it was in the 18th century medical profession, but there were also available in the Cape European folk remedies, traditional koi and African heating systems, and also a hybrid set of medical practices brought from the East by slaves. All of these were tried, but against smallpox, not one of them had anything really effective to offer, whether they required bleeding, or balm, or buchu, or a brew of lemon water and herbs. They were equally ineffectual. But in desperate conditions, every one of them was tried, and sometimes even crossover. Colonists tried some koi tried some colonists, but not one of them really had any significant effect. If one looks at where there was a degree of uniformity in response, not surprisingly, it was in the realm of religious belief. In the midst of an epidemic, as you will hear time and time again in these five lectures, religion is sought as a way of trying to explain, trying to mitigate in some way this otherwise dreadful epidemic. For instance, slaves who practiced Islam before their enslavement in the East would have put their faith in talismans or azimats containing Quranic quotations, which they would have worn if they were permitted to do so, as a way to fend off the epidemic. For Calvinist Christians, fasting, prayer to God to, in the words of one contemporary, to stay his smiting hand from meting out a well-deserved punishment. That was a religious response. For both Khoi and Xhosa, they cast around, as was their custom and was their wont, in the face of evil, for who was the malevolent human source of such extraordinary calamity? To many Khoi, it seemed that the answer was obvious, for they were heard, quote, cursing the Dutch who had bewitched us. Not that they were alone in pointing fingers. As I've already mentioned, the medical profession in Cape Town were quick to point fingers at slaves as likely carriers of infection. And to these, they subsequently pointed fingers also at the town's coy female domestic workers. They were identified as a likely source. And so during the epidemic of 1755, many inspections of where coy domestic servants lived revealed that they were living in overcrowded, insanitary, unhygienic conditions from which, quote, from which inevitably an even greater disaster must arise. And so during the 1755 epidemic, coy domestic workers were ordered to leave their dwellings at once for the homes of their employers. Those who did not do so were forced into the countryside to work on farms. The channeling of these coy domestic workers, these women, to farms points probably to one of the significant economic consequences of epidemics in the Western Cape, a shortage of labour. To offset the loss of many of their slaves and their seasonal farmhands to smallpox, farmers, in the wake of the epidemics, energetically recruited new labourers from amongst the now immune coy survivors. Those who had contracted smallpox survived and were now immune. And probably they did so rather than purchasing new slaves because the price of slaves rocketed in the wake of epidemics. They became too expensive to buy on account of shortage. In the southwestern Cape, many remnants of shattered coy families thus by 1720 had become permanent agricultural workers, recruited by farmers deliberately to make up for the labour shortages. In the Overberg, this move to recruit coy as agricultural workers was slower. It's more likely there that it was about another 50 years, by about the 1770s, that many of the agricultural workers were coy. The epidemics of 1755 and 1767 were therefore, in the words of one historian of coy society, major catalysts in the Overberg Khoikhoi's transformation into farm labourers. Khoi kraals became reservoirs of farm labour to trekboer farmers in the vicinity. Every sector of already eroding Khoi life was assailed by these three epidemics of 1713, 1755 and 1767. Flight from the ravagers left their traditional grazing land open to occupation by colonists. Many of them, in their flight, vacated their huts left open were torched because they were identified as perhaps being possible sources of infection. Khoi leaders, who'd given their social and political structures cohesiveness and direction, died, often covered in grotesque pustules. And most destructively of all, their numbers thinned. Suddenly, critically, irreparably, by a disease which you can almost think of the powerful phrase I read, it whipsawed through the ranks of Khoi society. Not just once, but thrice in the 18th century. Not only killing by the score, including successive generations of children, struck down, depriving Khoi society of a new generation to develop into adulthood, but also leaving many of those who survived disfigured, physically and psychologically wrecked, and critical in terms of the inability of Khoi society to reproduce itself, infertile. The consequent low birth and high child mortality rates would have produced amongst the Khoi an unwavering trajectory of the population downwards. Whereas the settler population was able to rebound from the severe losses to smallpox because of the arrival of immigrants from Europe, many of whom had acquired immunity to smallpox in Europe, there was no source of demographic renewal for the Khoi. Scattered on farms throughout the Cape, their language, their history, their culture, increasingly a fading memory. They were transformed from independent pastoral Khoi into servile colonial Hottentots. Not that this is peculiar to the Cape. If we look at the West Indies, if we look at Latin America, if we look at Australia, the Arawaks, the Aztecs, the Aborigines all suffered a similar fate at the hands of diseases like smallpox. But in the case of the Khoi, their traumatized society and the structures collapsed very dramatically under the sustained process of colonization and contagion. If one is looking for any explanation of this process, of the collapse of Khoi society as independent socially, economically, politically, the variola virus must play a decisive part. Okay, so that's the pre-vaccination age. I need a sip of water and then we'll talk about the vaccination age. To you that the spread of smallpox during from the 16th century onwards associated with the rise and expansion of European commerce really was a marker of what one might call early globalization. The spread of smallpox is so closely associated with the growth of maritime traffic that this is closely linked to what one would call today the beginnings of modern globalization. The same is true, but even at a more rapid pace, of the spread of the concept of vaccination. As I indicated right at the beginning, it was devised by Edward Jenner in the 1790s in England. But within a very short time, it was around the world. An indication of the speed at which, the accelerating speed at which, not only produce, not only goods, but also ideas began to spread. So one should think of the spread of the idea of vaccination and the actual implementation as a marker also of accelerating globalization. Within 18 months of the publication of Jenner's path-breaking work in 1798, news of it had reached the Cape. And by 1803, vaccination was tentatively being rolled out by the authorities at the Cape. To a combination, and now you must just think of what had been the experience, the dreadful, dire experience of generations at the Cape before this, to the response of, it must have been a combination of euphoria and disbelief amongst residents that a disease which had been so deadly to the town for so long, three generations, could be prevented. In the words of Lady Anne Barnard, they have a horror of smallpox beyond all belief. And so the arrival of vaccination must have been almost incredible. That just by almost a little pinprick, this dreadful, dire disease could be prevented. By 1805, over 5,000 vaccinations had been performed in Cape Town. And an expedition had been mounted into the Western Karoo to spread the gospel of vaccination inland. We really are talking about the beginning of a new age in the history of smallpox, the age of vaccination, which is why I made that distinction. The proof, I suppose, if we can play with words, the proof of the vaccine was in the preventing. And this was soon demonstrated during the outbreaks of the disease in 1807 and 1812. In neither of the epidemics of 1807 and 1812 did mortality top 1%. Remember back in the 18th century, 25%, 35%. Compared to those figures, 25, 35%, this to contemporaries must have seemed miraculous. The governor, now take a British colony, the governor declared that this confirmed, quote, in the most convincing manner, the efficacy of vaccination, which the new British administration had pressed very strongly on Cape Townians. At the height of the 1812 epidemic, for instance, a team of doctors had systematically vaccinated the town's inhabitants street by street. Not that all Cape Townians readily bared their arms or opened their arms to this newfangled preventive procedure. They were somewhat suspicious, or at least some were somewhat suspicious of this astonishing miracle procedure, and also they were very suspicious of fumigation and sanitation and cleaning and street cleaning. All of these were quite novel. And closures of houses where smallpox had occurred began to build up a degree of suspicion, perhaps even hostility. In some cases, religious principles, cultural traditions, fear of the unfamiliar. Remember that the Cape had not had experience of inoculation. Inoculation was unknown at the Cape. All of these began to fuel a degree of discomfort and uncertainty about this new vaccination, and particularly vaccination with a fluid from an animal disease into a human, suspicion of these innovations by this, and again, an alien British administration, one which had just taken over. All of these began to produce a degree of doubt and uncertainty, and indeed of resistance. Both Christians and Muslims who thought along these lines shunned or hid from vaccinators. Some Muslims were even reported to have sucked what they called the poison, because another rumor going around was that this was actually a way of poisoning people, that it had a toxic effect. They sucked the poison from the arms of newly vaccinated co-religionists. And so, as the epidemics of 1807 and 1812 faded from memory, the government's zeal to vaccinate the population ebbed, so that within a generation, vaccination became all but unknown amongst a greater body of the people. And you will know from what I said, that of course meant the growth of a non-immune population. As the number of non-immune Cape Townians began to rise, so did smallpox recur, thrice more in the 19th century, in 1840, in 1858, and in 1882, 1883. In 1840, as in 1812, it arrived aboard a slave ship from Mozambique on its way to Brazil, while in 1882 it arrived on a steamship from Britain. Given that that slave ship, which brought it in 1840, was a prize ship captured by the Royal Navy's anti-slavery squadron, it's clear, if you think that came from Mozambique, captured by the Royal Navy in 1882, it came from Europe, that the source of infection had changed with the difference in the colonial rulers. No longer the Dutch, and so the infection no longer crossed the Indian Ocean from the Dutch East Indies, but now from areas of British contact. Britain's growing military, commercial, and transport footprint in southern Africa also meant that the 19th century epidemics were not slow to move beyond the Cape Peninsula. The epidemic of 1840 spread very swiftly to the Transkei. Epidemic of 1858 travelled beyond the Orange River, at least as far as Lake Ngami and the Limpopo River. Amongst the inhabitants of those areas, the belief was, the tradition was, smallpox always comes from the south, i.e. from the Cape. An explorer who travelled there in the 1850s was told that. Although in absolute terms, these three 19th century epidemics, 1840, 1858, 1882, 1883, claimed more victims than their 18th century predecessors, but one needs to remember that the town's population by then was substantially larger. But if we look at rates, the rates were significantly lower. In 1840, 12% was the mortality rate, in 1858, 8%, and in 1882, 7%. And undoubtedly, this lowered mortality was the result of the revival of official vaccination campaigns after their lapse between 1812 and 1840. Apparently in the 1870s, one of the common forms of greeting in Cape Town was to say, "How's your arm?" because so many people had been vaccinated. Also, probably stricter steps to curb smallpox once it arrived had been introduced. These were largely the product of the public health movement then emerging in Britain, which required clean-up of insanitary conditions, systematic district-by-district provision of medical and material relief, and relief to the poor. And we can see, though this is not from the Cape, the rolling out of vaccination. This is, in fact, the original is a photograph, but it's been engraved from Natal, early in the 20th century, of people being lined up and being vaccinated. Another feature of the British administration when smallpox hit was to set up designated special smallpox hospitals where quarantine, isolation, disinfection, and the burning of victims' clothes and bedding were undertaken. And indeed, here's a print of the special smallpox hospital set up at what was called in 1882 Wrensky's Farm. It's today where the Brooklyn Chest Hospital is, back of Pardon Island, of smallpox victims being brought in. And you can see here already evidence of some kind of organized, systematic, a special designated smallpox hospital, special wagons, Red Cross wagons, and smallpox victims treated there. As in 1812, however, these measures did not go uncontested, particularly by Muslim Cape Townians, whose sense of identity and political voice had begun to grow with the end of slavery in 1838. Many of them still trusted to their traditional talismans, their azimuts to wear around their necks. They believed in still traditional spiritual medicine. They objected increasingly to these biomedical preventives, like vaccination, like isolation, like fumigation. They argued that these ran counter to divine will, and they argued that the special smallpox hospitals like this were to be avoided at all costs because they didn't provide halal food or facilities for performing the necessary rituals on the dead prescribed by Islam. Indeed, and the suspicions which they had were fairly widespread, they suspected that the staff at the Wrensky's Farm smallpox hospital were all too ready to bury Muslims in the same way as they buried non-Muslims, in a hurry and in a coffin. Malays, in the words of the local doctor, very critical of this behaviour, Malays despise all our nostrums and look with contempt on all prophylactics. And here from the same series of sketches, the absconder, a patient absconding from the smallpox hospital with some of the warders chasing after him to catch him. As in countless other instances in Asia, in Europe and the Americas, where burgeoning ideas of biomedicine and their institutions collided with traditional beliefs and practices, this brought to a head a clash of cultures very starkly. In 1840 and 1858, when Muslim identity and Muslim political clout was still not well developed, this opposition largely took the form of avoidance. But by 1882, with a much more organized and politically aware Muslim community in Cape Town, Muslims' resistance had swelled to include threats to sanitary inspectors who were out searching for cases, and even holding a public protest meeting at which one community leader warned that he would shoot anyone who tried to remove his children to the smallpox isolation hospital. The municipality and the colonial government recognized that discretion was the better part of valor, particularly when dealing with an enfranchised part of the population, and Muslims were enfranchised. The town council therefore arranged for halal meat to be supplied to the hospital, for a Muslim nurse to be employed to tend the patients there, and for a dedicated Muslim ward, and for a tent to be erected for ritual washing of the Muslim dead. Such official compromises, however, were not favoured by the town's whites. To them, Muslims' apparent intransigence confirmed and stigmatised the stereotype of Muslims as being other, as being antediluvian, as being anti-modern in their practice, as being hidebound by traditionalism. In the words of a very upright and dismissive Cape Times, "The Malay doctrine of predestination tends to make them reckless in such matters, no precautions in their opinion having any effect in averting what is decreed." Not that holding non-biomedical view of the disease was the only reason to oppose public health measures. If we look at the case of Kimberley in 1882-83, the source of opposition was very different indeed. In 1882-83-84, several leading doctors in Kimberley, doctors who, and it's not irrelevant, had close links to the diamond mining industry of Cecil John Rhodes, publicly denied that smallpox had broken out amongst the migrant workers. Indeed, they diagnosed them as suffering from a rare skin disease. They appear to have done so because if they had admitted that these men had smallpox, the labour supply would have been affected, the supply of goods to the diamond fields would have been affected, and mining operations would thereby have been interrupted. Led by Dr. Leander Starr Jamieson, Cecil John Rhodes' right-hand man, these anti-smallpox doctors in Kimberley in the 1880s waged a fierce war of words against those doctors who said, "But it's obviously smallpox." For over a year, this raged in the local newspapers in Kimberley. Consequently, measures to curb the epidemic were sporadic, or in the mining compounds, they were non-existent. Cases topped 2,000 with mortality of 3.5% of the population. Only when the colonial government eventually called in a string of outside doctors to diagnose the disease, who said, "It's smallpox, quote, pure and simple," was this cover-up terminated and vaccination, fumigation, isolation were pursued. Here's denial. A conspiracy of denial, not for religious reasons, but very probably for sheer material and economic reasons to prevent any disruption of the diamond mine industry. Significantly a contributor to the over 700 deaths in Kimberley as a result of smallpox by the delay in preventing these measures. This blaming of a malevolent individual or a group for a catastrophe like an epidemic was as usual in the 19th century as it had been in the 18th. And you'll see this theme running right through this week. Finger pointing and blame as human beings, it's our fallback position in the face of an epidemic. In Cape Town, the belief that contrary conduct by Muslims was partly driven by an animus against whites yielded rumours that Malays were deliberately seeking to infect whites with smallpox by carrying their dead on biers through the streets in, quote, a reeking procession, or by rubbing shoulders with them in public spaces, or even by getting Muslim laundry women to drape whites' washing over smallpox corpses before returning it to its owners. As with most of finger-pointing, such accusations usually reveal more about the pointer than the pointee. A great deal of insight into their mind. But such thoughts, as you well know, often, sometimes, lead to action. At least twice, whites were so inflamed by these tales that they attacked Muslim residents with carbolic acid to punish them for spreading the disease. Not that white Cape Townians had a monopoly over conspiracy theories to explain smallpox epidemics. We pick up similar blaming and finger-pointing amongst the busters north of the Orange, who accused the Korana, their near neighbours, of bringing the disease to them in 1804. Tswana blamed the Ndebele for ignoring ancestors' instructions and so provoking an epidemic in 1835. And in the Transkei, also saw the British colonial government's hand in the disease which was, quote, secretly destroying us. For the devotees of universal religions, however, there could be only one source of smallpox, and that was divine action. To Muslims, the will of God, the taqdeer of Allah, behind this epidemic was unknowable. It perhaps might be assuaged by an appeal for mercy through fasting and prayer. For Christians, the epidemics was a divine punishment for sin. Quote, a remarkable visitation of God, which spared neither old nor young, but swept them away as with the besom of destruction. The only escape for Christians is repentance and prayer. Whites should return to their Bibles and to their knees before God. Even with all of these, all this evidence of public health initiatives reducing the impact of smallpox, long-term public health measures were very slow to be introduced. Once the epidemic had ebbed, so reasons were found not to introduce major public health initiatives. And so there's a long time gap between epidemics and actual consequences. The erection of wash houses to try and prevent contamination, prevent infection up at the streets. And those wash houses are still up there above Plattekloof. Public health measures to tidy up and clean up where stock was slaughtered on the beach. And also, very significantly, a deliberate decision that large numbers of people buried close to the city would in some way cause infection. And so after the 1880 epidemic, eventually it was decided to remove all of the cemeteries along Somerset Road. And here's an unusual print of this underway. The cemeteries along Somerset Road being dug up and the remains being transferred to Maitland. This is just one of the public health measures which followed in the 1880s and 1890s. So if we pull all of this together, for two centuries, smallpox was to southern Africa what the plague had been to medieval Europe in terms of its devastating demographic destruction and the terror which it evoked. And that's summed up for me in that subtitle which I've put to this lecture. An old sand hunter remarked after smallpox had swept through the area north of the Orange, there are no people left, only stones. Yet the invention of vaccination as an effective preventive against smallpox gives smallpox, I think, another significance in southern Africa's history. Because as a prophylactic measure, it was disseminated through the region during the 19th century by medics, by missionaries, by ministers. And the success of vaccination in significantly limiting smallpox gave to biomedicine, which was the source of vaccination, a greater and greater power and significance and influence in southern Africa. It represented biomedicine at its best, par excellence. It gave a powerful boost to that medical system, giving it superiority over other medical systems as it sought to penetrate amongst the wider population. I think it wouldn't be far off the mark to suggest that the spread of biomedicine in the 19th century was led by the tip of a vaccinating lancet. That's Jenner's lancet. Thank you very much.